We try to take public transportation, or we drive a hybrid or an EV. We recycle, use less, turn off the lights. But have you thought about changing your diet to save the planet? Welcome to the full story on WSHU and online at WSHU.org. I'm Ron Ropiak. Hope you had a nice weekend, as wet as it was. Here's my question for you today as we start the week. What did you eat over the weekend? Did you have a steak? Maybe a nice juicy cheeseburger? Maybe you had fish? Did you have some swordfish? Did you think about where your food came from? Was it from a farm nearby, or did you have it flown in? Some environmentalists say if you want to make a difference for climate change and global warming, there's something we can all do right now, right this very second, and that's how we can change things. We have to change how we eat. So, let's get right to it. We have a number of guests for you today. We're going to start with Lorraine Mangello, associate professor at the New York Institute of Technology, an expert on public health and nutrition. Professor, thanks for your time today.
Ron, pleasure to be here.
Can I, they spoke about it just a few seconds ago in the NPR broadcast, but the news that came out from the UN this morning, it seems like it comes out almost every week now. It's startling news. And I clipped a little piece from the New York Times, and if you don't mind, I'm going to read just a portion of it. It says, humans are transforming Earth's natural landscape so dramatically that as many as 1 million plant and animal species are now at risk of extinction, posing a dire threat to ecosystems that people all over the world depend on for their survival. And then it goes on, human actions threaten more species with global extinction now than ever before. And it says humans are relying on significantly fewer varieties of plants and animals to produce food. From someone in your line of work, that has got to be disheartening to hear.
It is quite disheartening, and it's really just the tip of the iceberg. We're not just losing biodiversity. The plants, the foods that we depend on for feeding the planet, climate change is actually changing those foods as well in ways that we never imagined would happen.
Is this something that most people actually think about? I mean, in conversations that I have, I have to be honest, it never really comes up. I mean, I've talked with many people about, okay, turn off the lights, recycle, do all the things that I was saying at the beginning. But the conversation about changing what we eat never comes up.
It's coming up more and more recently, and I'm very pleased about that. And part of the reason we're hearing more about it, there was a nice spread in the New York Times a couple of weeks ago, is that recently a commission that was convened by the medical journal The Lancet, 37 leading scientists from 16 countries around the world, they actually sat down and set targets for healthy diets and sustainable food production. And nutritionists, we knew what needed to be done, but we didn't have an organized way to approach it. But we looked at the science, and we now have targets that are doable, that are reachable. And, you know, as you said in your introduction, people are doing a lot of things, but often they don't feel they're in control. You may not have the ability to bike to work. You may not have wind energy in your community, but you have a choice on what you eat. That choice is yours, and that choice can be impactful when it comes to changing the environment. The way we grow food, the way we transport food, is really devastating to our environment and climate instability. Most people, I don't think, realize that greenhouse gases, 20% to 30% of them are emitted from agriculture, from livestock, how we grow, transport, and fertilize our food. Agriculture takes up about 70% of the Earth's fresh water. Loss of biodiversity, as you were talking about, when we lose the biodiversity, we are eliminating a lot of carbon that can be sequestered. Eating 1 pound of beef is the equivalent of the emissions that you would release from burning 1 gallon of gas.
Are you talking about specific choices? Are you talking about cutting out meat, beef, or are you also talking about chickens, pork, turkey, things like that?
Well, there, they're simple steps a person can take. And being a nutritionist for many, many years, I know the best way to get somebody to make a change is not to tell them not to eat something. Mm. So I'm not saying don't eat meat, but we certainly have to eat less of it. The focus really needs to be on a plant-based diet. So you start out with vegetables, fruits, beans, nuts, soys, whole grains. This is the base. That's step one. Step two is some optional dairy. Each day, one serving of dairy food seems to work best. A cup of milk, an ounce of cheese, 5 ounces of yogurt. Step three, you have optional seafood, poultry, or eggs. Small serving, about 3, 3.5 ounces. And then step four, because most people are not willing to give up red meat, beef altogether, and I'll talk a little bit about beef in a second. Mm-hmm. But step four is every once in a while you can swap your serving of seafood, poultry, or eggs for a serving of red meat. Again, about 3 ounces of meat is really what it's going to take to be sustainable. 3 ounces of red meat, of beef once a week may not sound like a lot. It isn't. But you can also look at it maybe instead of once a week, a 12-ounce steak once a month. For most people, that's more achievable, more realistic than saying, you know, they will never have beef again. But to answer your question, why beef? Beef is more impactful on the environment. It is incredibly inefficient how a cow changes energy into food. It takes somewhere between 18 and 15 pounds of grain to produce 1 pound of beef. Think about that. If we can feed 15 pounds of grain to people, we can do a lot to decrease hunger and malnutrition in the world. We use, as I said before, about 1 gallon of gas for 1 pound of beef, about 2,500 gallons of water. In comparison, to produce 1 pound of wheat, it's only about 25 gallons.
Hmm.
Only about 10% of the grain that we grow in this country is consumed by humans. Okay, 64% of our cropland is used for feed for livestock. It's just an inefficient use of energy.
Professor, I only have 4 minutes left with you, and okay. I'd like to get you back in the future for a much longer program.
Sure.
But can I ask you, because I know you work with the younger generation, some of the, mm-hmm. the quote-unquote older people that I know say, look, I am who I am. I'm not going to change my habits at this point. Are you concentrating on changing the dietary habits of the younger generation?
We all need to change our dietary habits. One consumer group that promoted this planetary health diet, they framed it as the grandparents' diet. It's healthy for you and healthy for the future of your grandchildren. So I don't want to leave out older people. I see a lot of energy and enthusiasm with younger people. They are realizing that this is their future, that they need to make a change. And I am focusing on younger people. I mean, that's who I work with. One of the things that is most alarming to me is that younger people are so removed from the process of growing food. One of the things we do here at NYIT is we have a garden, and I take my nutrition students into the garden, and we compost. And composting is a wonderful way to put carbon back into the soil. And that's, again, something that everybody can do. And hopefully my students are learning these here at NYIT, and then they're taking them home and using these methods at home. The point is it's everybody needs to make these changes. It's not, you know, up to one group or one individual. And that's, you know, why I focus now more on population and global health. Spent a lot of time trying to focus on individual. I was a dietitian counseling people for many years. And it's good to tell somebody to eat less saturated fat, let's say from milk. Milk is the biggest natural contribute of saturated fat to the diet. But if that person leaves my office and goes to a place where there's no low-fat milk, that's not useful. They can't implement what they've learned. So I went to public health, and I worked on policies and encouraged people to policies to take the saturated fat out of diet. So now a student may go into a lunchroom, and there's low-fat milk there. And that's great for the population, the community. But it wasn't good enough for the planet, because if you take that fat out of milk, that's fine for that student drinking that milk, but that fat is still in the food supply. That cow still produced tons of methane in the production of that dairy product. So it needs to be a global approach. And really the best news about this is what's good for our planet is also exactly what's good for human health. It really is a win-win situation. Plant-based diets, optional dairy, a little bit of meat each day, lots of variety, eating local, all of the things that you said in your introduction. These things are doable. And in a time when a lot of people are losing hope, we have these dire warnings every day about what is happening to our environment. This is something that you can feel good about. You can choose that escarole and beans, for example, rather than a hamburger for dinner.
Professor, I got to hold you for 1 second because
sure.
we do have to take a break. And my apologies, you are with us
no problem.
The next segment. So I get to ask a few more questions, and I'm grateful for that. When we come back, I'd like to ask you about seafood, which my doctor tells me I should eat more. And then I read some articles saying you can only have certain types of seafood. That'll be good for the planet. And I also want to mention that you had referenced the article in the New York Times, and I have to tell everyone that there is a wonderful article in the Times. It's called Your Questions About Food and Climate Change Answered. And it goes on for a good 20 pages or so. And it's exactly what we're talking about today. This is The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. What do you eat? Let us know. TFS@WSHU.org. We're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. I'm Ron Ropiak. Today we're talking about eating healthy, and eating to save the planet. We're talking with Professor Lorraine Mangello, Associate Professor at the New York Institute of Technology. And coming up in just a moment, Katie Andrews is going to be joining us. Katie is a registered dietitian and the owner of Wellness by Katie in Westport. Professor, I have a question for you about seafood. We've talked primarily about beef right now, and obviously cutting it down and trying to be healthy. But I need to ask you about seafood because my doctor says eat more seafood. He tells me eat more salmon, eat cod. And then I read an article saying don't eat cod. That's bad for the environment. And if I eat salmon, it had better come all the way from Alaska. So I'm asking you, what do you think? What's the right way to go? Am I harming the environment?
It all gets rather confusing, especially when you're really trying to make the right choice. In terms of fish and health, fish has omega-3 fatty acids. We know about 7 ounces of fish a week decreases risk of cardiovascular disease. There's a very strong correlation between that. So we don't want to give fish up altogether in terms of a diet that's healthy for both you and the planet. We can't increase our catch of wild fish. We're overfishing as it is. But some good news on the horizon is there are parts of the world that they are doing aquaculture. I think in Vietnam and China, for example, they are using ponds to grow scallops, some shellfish, and other fishes as well. As in terms of farm fish versus wild fish, the bottom line is if we want to have fish in our diet, we are going to have to depend on some farm fish. Wild fish, most people say, tastes better and is probably better for the environment if we're not overfishing. But fish still has less of an impact than animals, especially beef, just because it has a shorter lifespan. One of the things that we do need to be concerned about, as the seas are warming, we do expect our seafood to be more contaminated. For one, in warmer seas, mercury is more readily absorbed by fish, so we expect fish to be higher in mercury. And those microorganisms growing in the ocean love the hot weather and the hot ocean, and they just grow, and we're seeing an increase in contamination of shellfish. So we do need to be careful for that. But my answer to your question is I think you still should consume fish. We're talking basically about 3 ounces or so a day would be a reasonable amount in place of the poultry. So fish and poultry, in small amounts, and then beef, basically, and lamb one time a week.
Professor Katie Andrews is going to join us for a few minutes. Katie, as I mentioned, is a registered dietitian and the owner of Wellness by Katie in Westport. Katie, how are you? Thanks for joining us.
I'm doing well. Thanks so much for having me.
What are you hearing from your clients nowadays? Do they mention any environmental concerns when they come to you?
You know, that's a great question. And I think there has been a focus in kind of the fad diet space that has more of environmental impact than I think we've seen historically. So I have a lot of clients or a lot of questions at events that I lead for people about kind of the paleo and keto diet trends that have become particularly popular. Paleo, I would say, 5 or 10 years now, really. Keto really gaining in momentum just in the past couple of years. And these are diet trends that have a much more a heavier focus on consumption of meat and dairy, which therefore will, of course, have an environmental impact. I think one of the most, you know, popular and kind of important trends that I see in nutrition among my peers and the experts of us out there is that having a diet that has more of a focus on plant-based sources of nutrition, particularly plant-based sources of protein, is really going to be the most sustainable way for us to consider the impact of what we eat on the environment. As a professor, I think has probably mentioned already, you know, the impact of whether it be cattle, lamb, poultry, dairy, eggs, you know, and seafood as well to a lesser extent, but the environmental impact of raising those foods, transporting them wherever they need to go, and then the impact of the animals themselves as they're raised, as well as what it takes to feed them, is just significantly more damaging than what we see from crops like, you know, tofu, soy, lentils, fruits and vegetables, et cetera.
You're talking about the methane that comes out of them and the manure, obviously.
Absolutely. That would be it.
Okay. I have a question for both of you. Professor, I'd like to start with you. Why should we think it's going to be different this time around? Because I'm sitting on the couch last night and I'm reading at the same time I have the TV on. To be honest, I was watching the basketball game. You're talking about changing a culture. And what I did was I started counting the burger commercials that I was watching last night. And I stopped because I ran out of fingers. You're talking about changing everything for us in the next few years.
It is definitely a challenge. And I am hopeful. There is the potential for people to change when they have to, and I think there are an awful lot of people out there that realize it's time to make a difference. And when you think about it, it's not really something new. The way we eat now is new. Up until the 1900s, two-thirds of our protein intake was from plant, and only one-third was from animals. By 1985, that has switched. We're eating high on the hog now, and it hasn't always been that way. The other focus that I like to emphasize with people that I counsel and my students is going back to their roots, to cultural foods, to foods that you ate for religious reasons. Every good cuisine out there has delicious meatless dishes. You didn't think of them as meatless. You didn't think of them as vegan. You thought of these were foods that my family has always eaten. They're delicious. They're affordable. And it really isn't a sacrifice. It does take a change in your mindset, and it really is all about how we frame it. And I'll leave you just with one antidote. Recently, the New York City School District decided to go meatless on Mondays. A great idea. It saves 1.1 million less pounds of carbon dioxide into the atmosphere. Students are just eating four less burgers per month. Well, anyway, I was watching that with my mom, who said, "That's ridiculous. Why are they taking hamburgers away from those poor children?" I was brought up Catholic. I turned to my mom and said, "You brought me up that way. We never ate meat on Fridays."
Never had meat on Fridays.
And it wasn't a sacrifice. I never really got the sacrifice there. I would eat delicious pasta and stuffed eggplant and all kinds of wonderful foods. It's how you frame the issue. You know, taking tile seems like something horrible, something that is part of your heritage, your culture. It's the norm. It's doable. And that's what we have to make healthy eating. Eating to sustain the planet, we have to make it the norm, not the exception.
For us on Fridays, it wasn't pasta, it was fish, but I'm right in the same boat with you. Katie, why is it different this time around?
You know, I think a lot of it has to do with food access and how we educate people, right? So when I work with clients, it would be very simple for me to just hand them a sheet saying, you know, eat less meat, less dairy, eat more plant-based versus tofu, beans, lentils. You know, most of this information isn't anything new to people. But where it becomes challenging is how do they prepare those foods? Where do they buy them from? You know, for people that aren't necessarily comfortable doing a lot of cooking, a bag of lentils might seem a little bit daunting, whereas, you know, picking up chicken that just goes into the oven or on the grill is very simple. So part of it is education, making sure that when you're encouraging people to make these choices to eat more plant-based, that they understand where to buy the foods, how to prepare them, which flavor profiles go together. As the professor said, drawing on things from your food history or culture can be very helpful. But even just, you know, simple recipes, things like a vegetarian chili in an Instant Pot can be very accommodating for someone who is intimidated by the idea of plant-based proteins especially.
Katie, I have a question for you because I need to ask this because you're in Westport. Westport is a relatively affluent town. It's a beautiful town. I love Westport. But here's the thing. It's got money. Let's put it that way. And when you change a diet to eat healthy in many cases, organic or better cuts of beef and so on, that primarily favors wealthier people. I mean, there's a reason, right, that a lot of the fast food places are in economically disadvantaged neighborhoods. How do you change that?
It's interesting you bring that up because that was kind of exactly where I wanted us to go next. We're actually seeing that more fast food restaurants are embracing non-meat foods. So we're seeing Burger King, Carl's Jr., even some local places. I mean, here in Fairfield, Plan B restaurant carries a Beyond Burger. These are less expensive. They are a great way to expose people to this concept of I can grab something fast and inexpensive, and it doesn't have to be both negatively impactful on my health and negatively impactful on the environment. But we need more and more of these kind of fast food places to sell and market these non-meat options. It isn't something historically that's ever been done. I think I've seen a veggie burger, you know, grace places like McDonald's or Burger King a couple times historically, and they tasted terrible. So how do you get people to want to do that? But, you know, companies like Beyond Burger are really doing a service to all of us by making these foods more available, keeping them at an affordable cost, and still marketing them as a burger, right? If someone's in the mood for a burger, and that's not to say that beef and non-beef are ever going to be exactly the same, but it's giving people a low-cost option, which I think is hugely important.
Professor Mongello, what's your take on the so-called fake meat products or something like Beyond Burger or the Impossible Burger?
Mm-hmm. You need to be aware, people need to be aware that just because something is vegan or vegetarian or you stop eating meat, it doesn't necessarily make your diet healthier. You could have a completely unhealthy vegetarian diet. I know that Burger King just announced that they are having a meatless option. I haven't had a chance to look at that, so I'm not sure how healthy it may be. It is probably, environmentally speaking, less of an impact, but we need to see what's in there. Some of the alternative meat products are fine. They're a good introduction to eating meatless. My preference is, though, if you want to eat tofu, it should be tofu. Don't turn the tofu into a tofu hot dog. Mm. It's just another processing step. There are so many wonderful meatless options that having a heavily processed one is okay, but probably not ideal.
Professor, I'd like to ask you about, you mentioned it before, local farms that are good for our communities. Many mm-hmm. cases, they are organic. Is that part of what we need to do for our future?
organic farming, first of all, doesn't necessarily mean healthier food, although it can be. Definitely by using less pesticides and herbicides, there is an advantage to the environment there. But if you are, for example, organically growing cattle and those cattle are grazing on grass, that doesn't necessarily lessen the environmental impact. It's actually about the same, or it can be a little bit worse. A grain-fed cattle goes to market about a year earlier than grass-fed cattle, so there's actually more of a methane release from that. It's definitely more humane and better for the animals, no doubt about that. But it doesn't necessarily reduce the impact. There are a lot of farming techniques that are known as carbon farming. We're putting carbon back into the soil. Lots of methods that can be used. Scientists, farmers are learning things new all the time. So there are ways to produce beef or pig or chicken that saves the environment or has less of an impact, but just because something is labeled organic doesn't necessarily mean that is one of those products.
I'm learning so much today, and I hope everybody is also. I find this to be a fascinating conversation. Katie, with just a few minutes that we have left, I know that farmers markets in the Connecticut region, Long Island, have just been proliferating the last number of years. What do you think about them for our future?
I think the fewer steps you can take away in the food chain from where food is produced, grown, harvested, raised to where it reaches your table is better for a few reasons. One, you know, you're absolutely lessening that environmental footprint. If something is driven from a farm that's, you know, say 30, even 40 miles away, it's going to be significantly different than something that was raised in another country, shipped then to you before it reaches your dinner plate. A couple other kind of important considerations. One is food safety. You know, the more interchanges that your food has with individuals in a processing perspective, the more risk there is to your food potentially having bacteria or coming, you know, in through different human hands. That's where we see food safety risk get higher, and the risk of foodborne illness outbreak increases as well. Finally, you know, there's a consideration of just supporting your local community. You know, I coming from, you know, I lived in New York City for many years, Boston as well, all areas that have fantastic farmers markets. But you go into other parts of the world and, you know, market shopping is really just a part of everyday culture, whether it's, you know, your fruits and vegetables, but also as a place to get your seafood, to get your even your meat, your dairy, your eggs. You know, the one thing I say to people often is not to be turned off. You know, some people get so wrapped up in this concept of everything being organic and that meaning that it's of the highest quality. What you may find at your local farmers markets is that not every food is necessarily going to have an organic label. It's something that the foods have to pay for in terms of the farm. And so it might just not be worth it for smaller farmers. But that certainly doesn't mean that their produce isn't going to be of the highest quality, that it isn't going to be, you know, tasty and obviously kind of marketed seasonally. So I encourage people as often as you can, and I know sometimes, you know, the price points at farmers markets can feel a little bit challenging for everyone, but as often as you can to try and support your local markets, both for your growing community, but also for your health.
Professor, with the 45 seconds I have left in this segment, could you give us your final thoughts, please?
Well, to continue with farmers markets, they're great, but one step better, grow your own food. Even if you have a small piece of property, even if you just have a few pots on your porch, you can grow a tomato plant, you could peppers, herbs, and then reuse your food waste. Don't throw those banana peels into the landfill where it creates more methane gas and more problems. Starting a small compost bin in your backyard, even if you're not growing vegetables, put it on your plants, your flowers. You're putting carbon into the soil where it belongs rather than in the atmosphere. So grow something this spring. Beautiful day out. plant a seed.
Finally, on No Rain, Lorraine Mangello is associate professor at the New York Institute of Technology and expert on public health and nutrition. And Katie Andrews is a registered dietitian and owner of Wellness by Katie in Westport. My thanks to both of you. I appreciate your time today.
It was a pleasure. Thank you so much, Ron.
Thank you. This is The Full Story on WSHU. If you would like to join in the conversation, you can email us, tfs@wshu.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at Full Story WSHU. We'll take a short break, and we'll be right back. It's The Full Story on WSHU. Let's change our conversation just a bit. Still keeping with the focus of our show today, but we're going to spend the next 20 minutes or so talking about the oceans and seafood and kelp and oysters. Professor Chris Gobler is the endowed chair at Coastal Ecology and Conservation at Stony Brook University's School of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. Professor Gobler works with Long Island oyster farmers to treat nitrogen-polluted waterways. Hi, Professor. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you, Ron?
I'm fine, thank you, sir. What's wrong with too much nitrogen being in the waterways?
Well, on Long Island and in many other places as well, too much nitrogen leads to an overgrowth of algae. And in some cases, those algae can be harmful to either humans or to the environment. For example, can lead to fish kills and the death of bivalves. And also the overgrowth of algae can lead to low oxygen. And all marine life needs oxygen to exist. So, ultimately, with too much nitrogen, you create a marine habitat that's unhealthy both for the animals that live there and sometimes for humans.
So, and just to clarify, I mean, we breathe nitrogen, don't we? We just need it
that's
in a
right.
proper
and
balance.
That's right. So, you know, the nitrogen in our atmosphere is it's 80% of our atmosphere. But what's been happening, particularly on the western part of Long Island and Suffolk County, is that we don't have sewage treatment plants, so the nitrogen from our homes, either mostly from wastewater but also a little bit from fertilizer, is getting right into the groundwater, and that groundwater that we don't drink flows right into our bays, harbors, and estuaries.
All right. So too much nitrogen going in. How do you fix it?
The biggest source is wastewater, so addressing the wastewater issue is important. But once it's in the water, something we've been looking at has been aquaculture, and specifically the ability of both shellfish like oysters, but also seaweeds to take up that nitrogen before it goes out and causes more harm in the environment.
So you want to plant something, sugar kelp, to fix this?
Yeah, so what we've done this winter, and actually one of the first times, or the first time ever on an oyster farm in New York, has gone out and co-planted kelp, a seaweed, with the oysters. And the kelp is like a regular land plant, so as it grows, it's pulling nitrogen and phosphorus out of the water. It's also pulling carbon dioxide out of the water, and as you had in your last conversation, you know that high levels of carbon dioxide are causing problems all over the planet, and even in the water with regards to ocean acidification. So they're pulling out the things we don't want, carbon dioxide, nitrogen, phosphorus, and putting in the things we do want, like oxygen.
And then the oysters like this?
The oysters do like this. I mean, one, as I said, on their own, the oysters filter water, and filtering the water, they're removing algae and removing nitrogen. But the oysters do quite well with the kelp in that that high CO2 can be a danger to the oysters, but by removing the CO2, you can actually protect them from that process I mentioned of high CO2 in the water, which is also known as ocean acidification.
Just a strange question, but do the oysters actually get bigger, tastier, meatier, do you know what I mean, from having this around them?
Well, I mean, we've just done the first deployment with the kelp, so it's hard to say that. But I can say in a laboratory setting, we published a paper just late last year that showed if you do co-grow seaweeds and oysters, they grow much, and they're experiencing high CO2, they do much better together than they do, the oysters do on their own with regards to their growth rate.
Sounds like kelp and oysters. It's like steroids for weightlifters. just keep
something
going.
Something like that.
Do you actually have to take the kelp and physically put it in the ground? Do you have to plant it like you would plant something in your garden?
So it gets set onto ropes in the late fall, and then those ropes are deployed. And when it's set on the ropes in the earliest life stages, you really can barely see it. And then it progressively grows through the winter. By January, we saw the little spores or seedlings growing off the rope. And then by March, we had three feet plus of kelp growing that's continuing today.
So it cleans up the environment and it makes the oysters happy.
Yes, exactly.
We're going to bring in two more voices to our conversation now. Paul McCormick is owner of Great Gun Shellfish Company. And he runs a commercial oyster farm along the Fire Island National Seashore. And Peter Haskell is also joining us, president of Haskell Seafood in Quogue. Peter, Paul, welcome. We just need Mary right now, and we can make a fortune as a musical group.
Great to be here. Thanks for having us.
How are you guys?
Very good.
Who's on the boat today?
This is Captain Peter Haskell.
I'm not on the boat today.
Peter, are you on the boat?
Yeah, we're on the Greater Peconics having a beautiful day of a commercial trip catching corgi. And we're having a lot of success and enjoying the weather finally this week.
I don't know if you had a chance to catch a bit of the earlier conversation. I know you're working. I know you're out on the boat. And the gist of our conversation today is, what can we do to change our diets to help the environment, save the planet? Because, you know, we're all hearing all the warnings about what's going to happen in our future if we don't change things right away. When it comes to seafood, are you hearing anything from your customers saying, look, I'm looking to do the right thing? Can you make sure that we're not overfishing in certain areas, that you're giving me seafood that's healthy and good for me? Peter, I'd like to start with you.
Yeah, absolutely. I think to start that conversation on resourcing local seafoods is quite important, because there's a tremendous amount of seafood that's imported into our systems that have a high carbon footprint, having traveled very far to get here. So a lot of our mantra and vision is to enable the public to follow a path and make a choice to find and discover local seafood that may be challenging to find in a restaurant menu, let's say, at times. So when it comes to health, I think, you know, local seafood clearly offers trace elements to one's diet that you might not find elsewhere, like selenium. And really, I think by honoring our local food systems, we've become very reliant on grocery stores, which really control our food systems at this point. Not that there's anything wrong with a grocery store, but there's also other options out there that people can buy locally from. And that's very much what we focus on.
And for those who love seafood, there is nothing like being at the dock when a catch is made and you come in and you get that fresh and you go home and you cook it. The taste is unbelievable.
Absolutely.
Paul, could you tell us a little bit about your shellfish company? You have a commercial oyster farm, don't you?
Yep, I have an oyster farm that I started. I started the company in 2013 and acquired a lease from the town of Brookhaven in 2015 and established the farm. It's a floating farm. The oysters are housed in mesh cages that float on the surface of the water, which is where the highest concentration of algae is. And basically, the farm, we're putting an indigenous species into its native environment. And the oysters are just filtering and feeding on the natural algae that are presently there. So it's an absolutely beneficial practice. It really moves beyond the notion of sustainability for all the reasons that Dr. Gobler pointed out. It's essentially a restorative practice. So in terms of, you know, thinking about are oysters good for the planet in terms of our diets, I believe farm-raised oysters and kelp, that represents a diet for a healthy planet, because the farming practices that produce these foods, again, they're not only sustainable but restorative. Dr. Gobler pointed out that, you know, oysters are filtering nitrogen and algae and detritus from the water. That in turn mitigates harmful algae blooms, improves water quality and clarity. And then you have things like seagrasses and other subaquatic vegetation returning to the environment. That further helps to improve water quality and so forth and so on. Another thing about the production of these particular foods, farm-raised oysters and kelp, is the physical structure of the oyster farm. provides new habitat for all forms of sea life. And kelp actually provides new habitat for sea life. So,
How many oysters do you have in your farm?
Presently, there's about 300,000 oysters on the farm. We're sort of at a low point now because we've harvested a sizable amount of last year's crop. But within a few months, we'll probably be up to about 600,000 oysters. And those 600,000 oysters, when they're at market size, and they're filtering 30 million gallons of water a day. So all of that filtration has a potential enormous benefit for mitigating these algae blooms and taking up nitrogen from the water.
So, Professor, what Paul is doing, are we looking at the future here?
Absolutely. I mean, the bottom line is our wild fisheries, not only have they reached capacity, but they're in decline. And in this country, 90% of the seafood that gets eaten is imported. So I think aquaculture, particularly the kind of what Paul just mentioned, restorative and regenerative aquaculture, that's actually just relying not on fish food to make the fish grow, but relying on the natural plankton and natural nitrogen to make the seaweeds and shellfish grow. It's a sustainable product, sustainable approach to aquaculture that I think I do think is the future. I think there's tremendous room to grow on Long Island. I'll just very quickly mention, you know, fisheries and shellfish has been at the heart of Long Island's history and mariculture for centuries. But the sad flip side of that is that it's also those stories have ended with the collapse of, for example, the South Shore clam fishery and the East End scallop fishery, and for different reasons, in some cases overfishing, other cases harmful algal blooms. But you can't overfish aquaculture because you only take out what you put in. So I do think this is the future.
Peter Haskell, tell us about the fishing grounds nowadays. Have you seen it improve, get worse over the last few years? What worries you?
Well, I'd say as an observer and a participant in our fisheries, we do have fisheries that are very vibrant and healthy. Today we're targeting corgi, which has a tremendous biomass. And when you have a fish that is so great in abundance, one of the jobs that we take on is to promote that fish and give it a more marketable personality in our seafood systems. So I might be suggesting that our fisheries are healthy, and as long as they're regulated and our regulations keep up with the change, I'm very comfortable with our stocks at this point in time. I also believe that there's a need for a unified industry of aquaculture as well as wild-caught, responsibly wild-caught seafood. So if we can progress as a country that way and a community and make this an encompassing industry, I think we'll only find success in the future.
So if I could read into what you were saying, because most people I know, if you go out to the store and you know, you're going to buy salmon and cod or maybe swordfish or something like that, and you're saying, you know what, there are a lot of porgies around right now. Have you considered porgy tonight?
Absolutely. I'll never tell a customer that illegally caught fish is bad to eat. It's okay to have swordfish once in a while, some striped bass. Nothing wrong with it, because our regulations do support that fishery is going to sustain itself. But at the same time, we need to consume more fish than that. So we really need to turn ourselves on to fish that we're not familiar with and balance our consumption. So in a lot of ways, we're selectively balancing our diets with what's available and what's local.
Paul McCormick, I'd like to ask you about the younger generation. The professors and the dietitian who were on earlier in the program were talking about getting the kids involved, having them eat differently. Do you find that the kids, do they come out to see the oyster farm? Are they enthralled by it? Do they want to work there?
Yeah, I have a lot of interest in young people wanting to work on the farm, wanting to see the farm. By and large, the folks that come out love oysters, love the taste of raw oysters. Almost everybody that comes out on the farm initially finds it to be a novelty. Very, very interesting. They want to tell everybody about it. Their friends ask them. They tell me when they come on the boat, I have to give a report to everybody when I get back, because everybody wants to know what an oyster farm is like. So I just think there's a natural, inherent, interesting component to farms, probably because they're not so popular. It's a very new type of thing, especially this modern small-scale oyster farm age that we're in. So, yeah, I think there's a lot of interest and there's a lot of potential for young people to get into the field. it's an endeavor that requires a lot of commitment, a lot of seriousness,
It's not an easy life, is it?
No, you really have to persevere. There are a lot of fundamental challenges that have to be faced and overcome. I mean, I'm essentially talking about farming. That applies to all farming.
Right.
But I like to think about, without making any sort of superior comparison, but just the reality is that when you're farming on the water, the basic thing is you're taking all of the challenges of land farming, but now you're applying it to a fluid environment. I don't just mean that literally. I mean in terms of motion. So, you have to contend with so much more in terms of the structures moving back and forth every single day, and chafing and breaking down, and exposure to the elements in a way that is even more difficult than land-based farming. So it definitely requires a lot. It requires an absolute passion to work on the water, and maybe a little craziness, but
it must drive you crazy when people say, why does this cost so much? And if they only knew, right?
Exactly.
Dr. Gobler, we only have about 2 minutes or so left. I'd like to give you and Peter Haskell some final words and final thoughts before we end the program. You first, please, Professor.
Yeah, I mean, again, I think this idea of regenerative and restorative aquaculture has tremendous potential for both New York and Connecticut. The idea that you can do something, you can grow seafood just based on the natural plankton and the natural nitrogen that's there without having to add anything to it, and at the same time be removing the things that are harmful to the marine environment, like excessive nitrogen, excessive phosphorus, and high CO2, and also with regard to the kelp being adding oxygen. So I see potential, tremendous potential for this approach. And I think, we haven't talked about the ability to eat kelp, but it's a delicious food product as well. So beyond, everybody knows how good oysters are, but kelp tastes real good too. So I think there's potential for food also.
It tastes good and it's great for you. And also Peter Haskell, president of Haskell's Seafood. Final thoughts, please.
Yes, final thoughts. I'd like to touch on some things that both Paul and Dr. Gobler had suggested. I believe that the restorative qualities of this product is a great benefit, as is oyster farming. I think as the dawn of aquaculture comes upon Long Island, we need to be very careful to make sure that the products are indigenous to our area, and it is a restorative practice. And having been able to work alongside some of the folks with this group in processing some of the kelp to get a first look at its viability, it's been great to discover how it is in fact indigenous, and it is a restorative practice, and that's the kind of thing we can get behind as a company at Haskell.
Paul, you get the last word. We have 30 seconds.
Eat more farm-raised oysters. Ask for more farm-raised oysters. Learn about aquaculture, and keep your eye on kelp.
You guys have got me hungry. I didn't have lunch yet, and can't wait. Paul McCormick, owner of Great Gun Shellfish Company, Peter Haskell, president of Haskell's Seafood, and Dr. Chris Gobler, endowed chair of coastal ecology and conservation at Stony Brook University's School of Oceanic and Atmospheric Sciences. Gentlemen, thank you. I appreciate your time today.
Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Thanks.
That's it for our show today. Julie Ferdino is our engineer. Carrie Frank is the digital editor. Our associate producers are Christian Carter, Sabrina Garone, Natalie Chafari. J.D. Allen is the producer. Ann Lopez is the senior producer. And Terry Sheridan, our news director. I'm Ron Ropiak. Thanks to all of you for being part of The Full Story.